Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by contributors from community radio stations across Canada. This episode of Groundwire was produced on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit by the Groundwire National Coordination Team in Toronto. I'm your host, Ome Salmarahemtula. On today's show...
You know, that's all she had, so she fought for what little she had.
They haven't even taken office yet, and they vow that this is what they intend to do.
The issue of murdered Indigenous women, that's about the land, that's about economics.
But first, here are our headlines. The following headline comes from radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Unoccupied Anishinaabe Akin homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nehiyawak and the Nakoda. On Wednesday, October 3rd, in a surprise announcement, Premier Brian Pallister declared his government would not be imposing a carbon tax on Manitobans as part of its commitment to tackle climate change. The Premier explained that his government's preferred option was to impose a flat fixed-rate tax, but decided to withdraw that commitment when, after months of negotiation, Ottawa refused to provide assurances it would not impose a different tax strategy on top of Manitoba's flat tax, one that would increase year over year. The Premier has argued that the additional tax will negatively impact jobs and economic growth, particularly in the agricultural sector. Lynn Fernandez is a research associate with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives Manitoba office. Her research interests include labour and environmental issues. Lynn expressed disappointment in the Premier's stance.
You know, and experts will say that it has to be at $300 a tonne before it really starts kicking in and having the effect that we want. We would obviously be a long way from that. Even the federal government is a long way from that. But it's just one tool in the toolbox, and at least gets people to start thinking about pricing pollution.
The Premier's move brings to the fore the number of provinces backing away from carbon taxes. Lynn Fernandez is concerned about the implications for the federal government's efforts to take on climate change.
You're going to have this provincial coup d'etat against the federal government's plan to bring in the carbon tax. So what remains to be seen is how the feds are going to respond to this. I will be surprised if they don't make some modifications to their carbon tax. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that they stand strong and do force the province to take on their version of the carbon tax. But I'd be surprised if we don't see some weakening of that as well.
Our next headline comes from Chris Cook of radio station CFUV in Victoria on unceded Coast Salish territory.
For the second time in less than a week, the residents of Camp Namigans have been uprooted and moved along from their latest home in Regina Park. Pro bono lawyer for the residents, John Haney, said the BC provincial government ordered Saanich police clear Namigans Nation from the BC Transportation Ministry land. The ministry insists the eviction is a safety issue and argued that before a judge when seeking a ruling for an interim injunction to be put in place while the status of the encampment was argued in a separate case. The judge allowed a 10-month injunction, making a provision that the point of charter rights in the case could be argued further at that time. Haney says,
An injunction of this type, and it's recognized, is essentially a final order, because once you've dispersed people, you don't anticipate that they're going to, you know, wait for the time it takes to have a court case, and if they're victorious, come back to the same place. They need somewhere to live now.
Haney called the decision an unfortunate contrast to how the courts had handled similar requests for injunctions against the so-called super intense city behind the provincial court a few years ago. In that instance, Haney says,
the court initially denied the injunction and said we're going to go to trial on these issues, including, you know, is your constitutional right a defense to being trespassers? Or said, we're going to have a trial of whether there's a Section 7 right to be in camp during the daytime.
It's not clear just where the 40-plus campers at Namigans Nation, many who consider themselves a community, are to go to next. Victoria CBC Radio quotes camp resident and homelessness activist Chrissy Brett saying, quote, at the end of the day, there weren't housing options that were made available to people who were at the previous site, unquote. The original Namigans provided a sheltering place for more than 100 people. The housing situation in Greater Victoria mirrors that of other cities, where booming real estate and building markets by turns raise rents, while renovating and demolishing affordable housing spaces across the region.
Our final headline comes from Catherine Fisher of CJLY on Sinaik's traditional territory.
This September, at the annual general meeting of the Union of British Columbia Municipalities in Whistler, BC, delegates discussed and voted on 143 resolutions, including two calling on the provincial government to amend the Private Managed Forest Land Act to bring it in line with regulations and forestry practices on public land. The Regional District of Central Kootenay decided to bring the resolution forward because of concerns about private land logging by the Nelson Land Corporation near Cottonwood Lake and Windell in southeastern BC. Private managed forest companies are not required to manage the land for the long term, and there are numerous examples of land being logged, then taken out of the managed forest and sold as real estate or for other types of development. This often results in adverse impacts on wildlife, water, and nearby communities, increasing risk of floods and impacting fish habitat by degrading riparian areas.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. You are listening to Grand Wire Community Radio News, available online at grandwirenews.ca. You just heard Ice Walker by Iskwe from her album The Fight Within. Now it's time for our feature stories. The National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls held its latest rounds of hearings in Winnipeg, which is situated on Treaty 1 territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. The week-long hearings extended from October 1st to the 5th and placed a special focus on family and child welfare. Michael Welsh of radio station CKUW 95.9 FM was present at the hearings and provides us with some of the voices presented at the event.
The National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Women and Girls has a mandate far broader than investigating the missing and murdered. It entails examining the systemic causes of all forms of violence against Indigenous women and girls. During the Winnipeg hearings, discussion centered around the child welfare system and the institutional oppression at its core. Cora Morgan is the First Nations family advocate at the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs.
Kids in care, they have one duffel bag with all their worldly possessions. And on the first day in the group home, it's almost like a prison movie that, you know, you have to defend yourself. And she ended up getting charged because girls were trying to take stuff from her duffel bag. And, you know, that's all she had. So she fought for what little she had. And it creates these dynamics of violence. And I think, that loss of value for life.
Dr. Cindy Blackstock is Executive Director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, a professor at McGill University's School of Social Work, and a renowned defender of Indigenous children's rights.
Once they're at a place where they're having suicidal ideation, there are very few services because of the inequalities again, to be able to support them so that they can work their way through that and be able to make healthy and positive choices for themselves. And that we also, at the same time, address those inequalities that have led to the problem in the first place.
Sue Caribou.
I have 13 in my family that are murdered and two missing. And I've been in the system since my parents were murdered in 1978. It took the inquiry to, you know, be for them to come and listen to us. And then, to me, I don't see no change yet, none whatsoever. It's still the same, yet it's getting worse.
Commissioner Michelle Odette is the daughter of a Quebecois father and an Innu mother. She entered politics at a young age, became the first president of the Quebec Native Women's Association, and later became president of the Native Women's Association of Canada.
Huge, huge, huge pattern across Canada. It's the colonialism system had and still have today a huge impact on all of us. All of us. That there were moments sometimes that, my God, I thought I was beyond that, that I was okay. But by receiving the truth, we realized that even ourselves, the staff, are affected by those way how policies, laws, or legislation are made, or program and services. So that, I saw that everywhere. What I noticed also that no matter where I'm from, I could be from Yellowknife or Kaska Nation, or I'm from Halifax. As a woman, the system failed me. The system failed me because I was born Indigenous and I was born woman, as a woman. And how things are set up, everywhere we went, they lost their children instead being supported to keep the children. And that, as a mom, proud to save five beautiful kids, it broke my heart each time I heard stories about that. But where I saw differences, it's how do we react and how, what's out there to help me to come out from that dark, dark experience or something negative. There's differences. So I understood many, many things this week. And I have to say, it was beautiful to see initiative. We don't hear enough, and it's rare. And I heard that this week, where an Indigenous organization will create a bureau for the children's advocate. You know, there's a children advocate. We should have that everywhere. Indigenous children advocate. That it's independent from the Indigenous leadership and government, but have the proper funding to do the job that they need to do. And I was like, oh, we should have that everywhere.
From Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nihiyawak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
October 4th is a day when community members across the country are called upon to honor the lives of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and where public gatherings are held in order to raise awareness and provide support to the families who have lost loved ones. More than 100 gatherings in every province and territory across Canada were registered with the Native Women's Association of Canada. We bring you the sound and voices from these vigils held across the country on October 4th. Taking place in the midst of the National Inquiry hearings, a vigil was held in Winnipeg at the historic forks of the Red Assiniboine Rivers, at a site where a special monument has been erected. Michael Welsh of CKUW was also present for that event and brings back the following audio.
They had identified that they didn't want to be trapped in trauma no more, sharing their story over and over and re-victimization. They wanted to be lifted up. They wanted to heal. They wanted to heal in different forms. So we tried to create and capture their vision of what that looked like.
Aneen, my name is Alaya McIver. That's A-L-A-Y-A-M-C-I-V-O-R. My role here is a family member that was a part of a team that put together an event in remembrance of missing Indigenous women, girls, and two spirits. It's a day of honoring across the country from coast to coast to coast. The Sisters and Spirits Vigil, so that was just in collaboration with that also. Any other questions?
Yeah, what's the story behind the morning?
Well, the monument was designed from the hearts and the minds of family members directly affected to the issue of missing and Indigenous women and girls. So it resembles resembles our loved ones.
And the significance in terms of support for the families and in addressing the.
So one of the things, so the monument itself resembles the silhouette of a woman, which we can all relate to. Could be one of our sisters, daughters, mothers, aunties, nieces. In our family member directly affected to the issue, right? Or one of our family members, sorry.
In continuation of Groundwire's coverage of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls' actions across Turtle Island, CKUT brings us footage from the 13th Annual Memorial March and Vigil for Missing and Murdered Native Women, Girls, and Two-Spirited People in Tihuatahake, or Montreal. Indigenous scholars, activists, leaders, and community members, as well as their allies, gathered in Cabot Square, a historical meeting place for homeless or transitory Indigenous peoples in Montreal on Thursday, October 4th. The area has witnessed increased social cleansing over the years with the influx of businesses and an ever-growing student population owing to the neighboring Concordia University and McGill campuses. The vigil culminated in a march to Montreal's Phillips Square, some 2 kilometers away. We hear the voices of Jessica Quijano and Ellen Gabriel, who spoke at the vigil.
Last year, I had a woman who went missing, and through pressure with the police, with my organization, myself, we were able to locate her. She was missing for over a month. She was being tortured and raped. We were able to find her. Her trial is going forward against her perpetrator. But what I'd like to say is that after I had accompanied her to the police, she had done her report. I had nowhere to send her to be safe. She's someone who was living on the street because she uses drugs and alcohol. I'm telling you all this because there's a great need for harm reduction services. This park is very significant because we're losing a very important resource, the open door, and is being moved out because of gentrification, because of people with money, women who are living on the street, who are living in poverty, are being assaulted on a regular basis, and it's just, this is a huge human rights issue. Plead to your politicians to go against this because it's people's lives that are being affected.
It is societal attitude that has created the marginalization of Indigenous women throughout this country, throughout this land. It is pretty evident through the actions, through the lack of a national plan of action in spite of the Committee for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, the Impermanent Forum, the Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, many human rights treaty-making bodies that have called upon Canada for over a decade to come up with a national plan of action. We are the last issue on election. Did you hear any kind of strong campaigns for Indigenous rights, the promotion of Indigenous rights during this last campaign? Is the CAC going to live up of implementing the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People? Because that means respecting, promoting Indigenous people's human rights, our authority, our jurisdiction over our lands and our resources, over our very bodies. It took 20 years to get this. And at that time, Canada, one of the 5 members of the Human Rights Council, was the only member of that Human Rights Council to vote against this declaration. Canada, for now, is saying that it will have a rights recognition in conjunction with Section 35 of Canada's Constitution Act of 1982. That's not good enough because we are sovereign nations. We have been oppressed for centuries. and that oppression is reflected in the harm that has come to Indigenous women and girls, the harm that was done in Indian residential schools. An apology is not enough. Money is not enough, because it's changing the mind. It's changing the mindset of society. It's changing how children are raised. It's changing the criteria of what a politician should be and could be. It's changing the criteria of judges and lawyers, those who control the justice system, who control our lives as Indigenous people, who criminalize us when we stand up for our rights, who criminalize us when we want to protect our homelands, the little tiny pieces of land that we are allowed to live on for our benefit and use according to the Indian Act, one of the most racist legislations in the world that still exists in this world. We have a rich language which is being threatened today by Canada's linguistic duality of French and English. It threatens our livelihood when they talk about coming in and raiding our cigarettes, when they come in and talk about criminalizing and arresting our people or standing against pipelines. Because what is going on the issue of murdered Indigenous women, of women and girls, that's about the land, that's about economics, it's about oppression of a people and keeping them down until they can't get up.
Love, Rage and Solidarity, 13th Annual March and Vigil for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, was co-organized with Iskweu, a project of the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal, Foyer pour Femmes, that aims to reduce and ultimately eradicate the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, including trans and Two-Spirit of Quebec. Footage from the vigil and march comes courtesy of CKUT reporter Lizzie Chapman. On the West Coast, Gnargio Sullivan was present for an October 4th vigil in Vancouver. Here is some of what she recorded. Our final feature comes from Montreal CKUT 90.3 FM broadcasting on traditional Mohawk territory. Last November, more than 168 Montreal-based groups and over 2,000 individuals joined a mass demonstration against the hatred and racism prevalent in Quebec. Following the provincial election of right-leaning Coalition Avenir Quebec a year later, organizers of the demonstration called for another mass mobilization against racism on October 7th, reacting to the normalization of far and alt-right discourse and action in the province and its co-optation of populist political parties like the CAQ, or organizers of the event called for border abolition and an inclusive society based on solidarity and inclusion. CKUT's News Collective brings us coverage of the event.
Angry. It's hard not to be angry when I'm getting profiled and getting my face slammed into the pavement. It's hard not to be angry when our mothers, our fathers are getting profiled, our brothers are getting killed, our sisters are getting killed, and nothing happens. No one speaks on this.
We are here at Place Emilie Gamelin at the demonstration against racism, xenophobia, and Islamophobia in Quebec, organized in part by Safa Shebi, Marilyn Lopez, and Al Harrington. I am speaking to
Joe Wallace.
And with whom do you work?
The Wolfpack Street Patrol, organized by Al Harrington.
What does the victory of Coalition Avenir Quebec represent for the province and for its migrant population?
The Coalition Avenir Quebec probably represents the same sort of menace for newcomers to Quebec that it does for a lot of the long-standing people here, which is that although much is made of the fact that they are explicitly targeting migrants, a substantial portion of CAQ senior membership are affiliated with Koch Industries think tanks. And whatever they intend to do to newcomers and Indigenous people in Quebec, eventually they probably will inflict upon les vrais Québécois eventually in due time. We're just on the front line. We're just the canaries in the coal mine. There was always an implicit permission from the government to do what they please. There were only ever perfunctory gestures of acceptance from the federal or provincial or city government. But now that has flipped from being implicit to not explicit in all ways, but explicit in certain ways. There is a certain amount of dog whistling and cultural signifiers being relayed to law enforcement, suggesting that they can do as they please and they can actually feel good about it. They've already started using the notwithstanding clause to enforce their vulgarized notion of laïcité within Quebec. They haven't even taken office yet, and they vow that this is what they intend to do. He has a majority, he has the will, he has a combination of either the explicit or the implicit support of any number of members of established Quebecois society. At this point, it doesn't seem like there's much that stands in his way other than potentially, with the right dedication and organization, movements like these. We'll see.
Thanks goes to CKUT's News Collective for that footage. Now it's time for our Community Radio Report. This episode's Community Radio Report comes from Michael Welsh of radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Niawak and the Nakota. Michael has a chance to connect with one of the staff at Burnaby radio station CJSF, a station which has recently secured a new off-site studio space, which it hopes will advance their goals as a community broadcaster.
Yep. I'm Jesse Wensloff. I'm the Public Affairs and Talk Coordinator at CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby on the unceded ancestral territory of the Coast Salish people.
Jesse, there's a CRFC-funded initiative that involves an off-campus space. Could you provide some background on that initiative?
We at CJSF are up on the Burnaby Mountain campus of SFU, which means that we're somewhat isolated from the rest of Greater Vancouver. And so for a long time, we've been looking for an off-campus sort of satellite studio to make it easier for volunteers to access the station, but also for interview guests and artists and all of that, and also just to be more connected to some of the nonprofit groups in the Vancouver community. And so for the last few years, we've been working towards securing a space in the building that's now called 312 Main, that used to be the old police building at the corner of Main and Cordova, right near Main and Hastings in the Vancouver's downtown east side. And so that building has been converted into sort of a community space where the Union of BC Indian Chiefs have taken over the fourth floor. The second and third floor are full of nonprofit organizations like the Dogwood Initiative and other community-minded groups. Megaphone, the local homelessness-focused publication, is also out of the building. So it's sort of a big community space with lots of like-minded groups, and we're really excited to have a studio space in the downtown. And as far as the CRFC grant goes in relation to that, we knew that we'd be moving into this new space, and that on top of the recording space we have, there's also some potential live performance or live event space in the building. And we really wanted to take advantage of that and activate the space and engage with the communities that we're joining in that area. So we're going to be hosting a bunch of bands to come in and perform in our studio. We'll be video recording that, and we're going to try to get a good mix of local and Canadian and global independent artists. And then in the public spaces, we'll be doing some live performances, but also putting together a number of public forum sort of speaking events. And we're really excited about those, because the goal with those is to partner with existing organizations, potentially within the building, but just generally with the community at large, so that they are sort of curating and choosing the topics and the speakers, and we are sort of providing support and allowing community groups to speak on the issues that are important in their eyes.
Could you comment on any of the challenges that you've had to confront in getting this project going?
This is actually the second time we've applied for a similar project. We applied last year unsuccessfully, and then with the feedback from the From the Radio Fund, we were able to craft a successful application this time around. But even just getting into the space, there are the challenges that go with construction and finding space in a community where space and real estate are at an absolute premium.
Now, we're also having this conversation on literally on the eve of your first fund drive. Why have you only begun now trying to raise revenue this way?
Our funding so far has come pretty much exclusively from the students of Simon Fraser University. Until now, we've never asked for financial support, so it's time is sort of what it comes down to. We also we're going to be moving pretty soon, and this isn't necessarily a, you know, we need to do this fund drive or we won't be able to afford to move the station. We are going to be depleting a lot of the money we've been saving in order to move when we do move. So this will help in that regard. But also as you and anyone who has done community radio stuff or, you know, many listeners will know, it costs money for new equipment and things aren't getting any cheaper. And yeah, so I guess that's sort of the reasons. We're starting on the evening of the 5th, which is a Friday, and then ending the evening of the 12th. This is our first fund drive. We've never done this before, so it's just a big change to some of our programmers to be asking for support this time around.
That's it for this edition of GroundWire, produced by the GroundWire National Coordination Team. Headlines this week were written by Michael Welsh, Catherine Fisher, and Chris Cook. We also thank Gao Mahadevan and the CKUT News Collective, Gennarji O'Sullivan, and Sheila Fernando for their contributions. Music this week was from Iskwe and Lido Pimienta. Tune in again to hear GroundWire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca. Thanks for tuning in.